most of the theories that I was reading on were all men. And most of the literature emanated from the United States. And I found that really disturbing.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
This is part two of a two-part series on home education with Professor Gary Knowles and Nathalie Zurnadin of the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education.
So we hear a lot about all the success cases in homeschooling and all the good points. And I wonder sometimes if the other side, the other perspective.
Oh yeah, there's plenty on that side. You know, I'm fearful about a number of things. You know, I think I've been into a lot of home educating family homes. And I've seen some wondrous things. And I've learned and appreciated those things. But I've also seen other things that bother me, like parents who are overly controlling or parents who are incredibly controlling of literature or material that children access, or parents who don't seem to be willing or open to allow children to engage with ideas that are oppositional to how the family feels. So, and families who in a sense shelter their children from the diverse cultures and races of society. You know, there are those things that bother me. There are those I get a little concerned when parents have, you know, singular religious objectives, because I think there's a certain things that can be learned in schools. Not that I want children to be socialized in all the negative things that go on in schools, but there are lots of good things that go on in public schools. And we ought to celebrate those. In fact, I would love to see home educating parents being more involved in public schools, particularly those who are critical of them, and at sort of helping, you know, schools overcome some of the issues that are clearly issues to be resolved. So I'm fearful about singular religious or other ideological perspectives that get that become very controlling of what gets learned and how it gets learned. But, you know, I also have to recognize at the same time these same kinds or similar kinds of practices occur in private schools, you know, where private schools are set up for some very particular purposes. And so I'm always mindful of how, in fact, children do need to be prepared to become citizens of our world and that particularly of our society and come to society with some really positive viewpoints about the possibilities of society, as opposed to simply being critical or withdrawing from it. And I've also, of course, seen parents replicate the very worst of teacher practices, the very worst of parental practices that we can imagine. So, you know, if we accept that, you know, all people have the right and to home educate, we also have to somewhat trust that some of this negative stuff will work out. But, you know, as I say all that, I have to acknowledge that public schools are sometimes very mean places and very unwelcoming places for kids, and that homes are often very, very safe places for children. And, you know, there's evidence, too, that a good number of parents with special needs children have had considerable success by taking on the challenging tasks of educating their special needs children. There's a whole lot of pluses, and there are the possibility of lots of minuses as well.
Natalie, anything?
Certainly, Gary has a different or more a rounder set of experience around home education than I do. He's got much more exposure about the so-called dark side or shadow side of home education than me. I've been, to use the word, fortunate to have been really exposed to what I consider the ideal context of home education, where the parents are really parent guides and provide a very supportive, nurturing environment for their children. From personal experience, I'm not familiar with that shadow side or the dark side or other side, but research, so literature, yes, I'm aware, and what Gary said is what is in the research, but I think that one thing that Gary mentioned about how a percentage of home educators, or Gary's hope is to see home educators work more closely with schools, I think that that's something that I believe that we're moving very slowly in that direction. And I say very slowly because I see some initiatives in various communities where that seed is starting to be planted. So, of course, it's going to take so many more years, but I think that that might be a future direction of seeing public schools working a bit more closely with communities of home educators.
What kinds of initiatives are you referring
to? Well, for example, how home educators may help, I mean, there are different points of entry into home education for parents. Some parents decide right away from before they have children that that's just the way it's going to be. They don't want to subject their children to a formal school structure. So that is indicative of one particular philosophy, and then others decide to home educate not almost by choice, but they're almost sometimes forced into it because they feel that the public system is problematizing their child too much. Mm-hmm. And so they decide to make some economic choices to have one parent withdraw from the workforce in order to provide a home education for their child. And so depending on the different philosophies of home education, but working a bit more closely with the schools in creating perhaps more learning from one another, developing more experiential learning environments, using community a bit more as a resource rather than having things just remain in a public school. Home educators are a fantastic example of how to better utilize resources that are found in a community, the public library, community centers, the economic vibrancy of communities, and I'm thinking particularly of Toronto. Toronto, I'm not from Toronto, but I notice that how each community is so economically viable. There are just different ways of perhaps in the future merging those two together, where the schools can provide opportunities also for the home-educated children to explore a different topic, perhaps more in depth with the having access to so-called expertise, and I'm putting expertise in quotes, but if a child wants to explore science more in depth, well, and the parent doesn't have access to that and maybe doesn't even have the funds to invest in the literature or provide the his or her child with that kind of environment, a public school can provide the child with that knowledge with the teacher there. So that's an example.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about Gary's studies, the grown home-educated kids when they become adults. There were some studies showing...
That was a life history study of adults who had been home-educated. And, you know, I was trying to get a sense of how they were in the world, the kinds of things they were doing. their reflections on home education, their reflections on the relationship between their home education experience and their present work time and life experience. And, you know, it came out of the idea that, well, it came out of the idea that so often touted that home educated kids suffer because they don't become socialized. And, you know, my concern was that, you know, what actually happens in schools is that public school kids, for the most part, in large schools, don't become socialized to communities or society. They become socialized to their peer group. And what becomes all important are their peers. And, you know, I'm interested in seeing a lot more vertical integration, for example, in the lives of children. And smaller schools in smaller communities, small classrooms, or vertically integrated classrooms achieve something fundamentally different. And, you know, I've argued for years that the question of socialization is a moot question. In other words, it's a question that people who are beginning their understandings of home education always seem to ask, well, will my kid be socialized? Well, they get confused by the question of social development and the question of socialization, two very, very different things. And, you know, there's no reason to suggest that within a family which is outgoing, which is mixing with community, where kids are involved in all different kinds of community groups, there's no reason to suggest that those children are disadvantaged whatsoever. I might question when, you know, when families are cloistered, children are sheltered and not exposed to broader community or society. I might have some big questions there, but in a general way, as I study these home-educated adults, I couldn't find reasons to really be concerned about questions of socialization to society. Because I think, in fact, you know, I would want my child to be socialized by, you know, younger people, older people, elders within the community.
There was also this talk about grown homeschoolers not being, usually not recipients of welfare and things like that. And
it was just, that's the point. It's just saying that, you know, they've grown up to be autonomous. They've grown up to be independent. They've kind of learned to make way themselves. They're confident in their place in the world, you know. And it's, I think that's one of the major advantages, that kids don't have their self-esteem attacked by other kids so much in the home context. And, you know, they become a lot more secure in who they are. And, you know, you see this and you feel it time and time again when you talk with home-educated kids. You know, I'm often so impressed with how they're able to engage in really sound conversations with people who are not just of their age group. You know, there's the generational differences, you know, are somewhat dissipated, I think, in the home education context.
Natalie?
Well, yes, and I would I was speaking last week with an adult who has been home educated, and she's a woman, and I was asking her if when she entered school, what were things that she had noticed, and I was, how to explain this, essentially she said that she was home educated up until high school, so she entered the public school system in grade 9, I think it is, and said that she was shocked to see how things are compartmentalized, the concept of race, how it's treated in schools, and also peer pressure around fashion, around, because she had a very strong sense of self. That was not able to be disrupted when she went to school. And she saw a lot of, she developed friends in the public school system that had a lot of self-esteem issues, and she was unable to understand what that was about. There's also a book by Susanna Scheffer, I think her name is, and all her research points to girls that have been home educated have a stronger sense of self and better self-image than children or girls that are educated in the public system.
One other question, wondering about the Ministry of Education. What are they doing to help, like, to expand some kind of possibilities, opportunities for home-educated kids? I'm thinking, like, there is a virtual high school that they seem to be working on as well. I don't know if you know anything.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure I can comment on that.
There's, I forget the bill number, but it's C, maybe 110, I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look it up again.
This is an Ontario bill?
Yes, where the home educators certainly have worked with the Ministry of Education to make it more, to make post-secondary education more accessible to home-educated kids. So I think that, personally, I'm pleased with what I'm seeing. And I think that all these efforts put together are making alternatives to public schooling possible. So I think that the Ministry of Education, despite it certainly not being perfect and really easy for kids, home-educated kids, to navigate, I think that it's much better than it was even 10 years ago. So we're slowly making progress. That's in my opinion.
An oppositional point of view is that, you know, the Toronto District School Board, as it now is, has made some regressive steps. And because Toronto had set up a number of very alternative schools over the years, and the alternative schools are finding it very difficult to remain in existence because of various pressures that are being placed on them, and that's kind of a little sad to see. So on one hand, there are more alternatives and they're easily accessed with respect to parents taking charge, but within the public system, I think we've got to, as a society, try and maintain a great diversity of schools rather than, you know, having a one-size-fits-all kind of model. I would urge public educators to rethink their potential closings of alternative schools.
Aboriginal First Nations, would you say that there is an underground community?
Certainly homeschooling and the way we've labeled it is a very Western way of looking at education. And what I would say based on my experience is that what I've come to observe on reserve, I think that the kids that don't do well in school, which is a lot, because they're confined to a particular way of education that's based on our model, sitting in rows at a desk with a textbook, completely decontextualized. And so there are some wonderful programs that are emerging on reserves that are trying to reclaim their educational philosophy. And so it wouldn't look like home education where it happens, home education defined as, you know, happening under a roof, alone maybe with your family, mm-hmm. but more in a community way. And they're also trying to integrate those programs into the schools to break down a very patriarchal Western way of education in order to be able to increase the success of their kids. I certainly have a lot of exposure to it, and I've taken some courses and done some research and did some other work in this area trying to be a very strong advocate for Aboriginal educational philosophy. And where I can, in my own personal work, in my very, you know, small way that I can be political, I will try and use a lot of their work to support what it is I'm saying. So to promote women's work, women of color, Aboriginal, First Nations, or Indigenous work. That's something that I'm, I think, fairly explicit about.
Thank you.
The first interview, the first part, I briefly mentioned someone's name that I was working with, Wendy, and I didn't go any further, and now is an opportunity for me to do that. So what I'm currently working on right now at OISE, at the Ontario Institute for the Studies of Education, I'm doing my thesis on a life history of a Canadian woman. And the name of the thesis, as it is now, is Wendy Priesnitz, a Canadian pioneer in the home education social movement. So, actually, I'd like to take this opportunity to say hello to Wendy, because I know that she's going to be listening, or she's listening. How I came to do this work, what brought me to this, is when I did my master's research, I was gathering the stories of youth in schools. And it eventually, when I finished gathering the data, their stories, I realized that all their stories revolved around their issues of public schools, their issues of their school experience. And so then I had to redirect my studies and tell their story and tell their experience. Now, what I did is I submerged myself into the research of alternative forms of education, progressive styles of education, and it took me a few months, but I was always disturbed by something until I put my finger on it. And I realized that most of the work, most of the theories that I was reading on were all men. And most of the literature emanated from the United States. And I found that really disturbing. And I thought, historically, education is a field that's relegated to women. Women at one point didn't have much of a choice as to what they were going to do. They were going to go into nursing or they would go into teaching. So I thought, well, where are their voices? Where are the women, the knowledge producers of the work that they're doing? Why is it always men? And so at that point, when I realized that, I was at the end of my master's. And I was on the verge. I was just weeks away from completing. And I had no other choice but to just make it a statement in my thesis. So I told myself, okay, this information is for me to store. I hold it inside of me. And when the time will come, I'll have an opportunity perhaps to address it. Which brings me then to now the work that I'm doing. I knew I had an opportunity to do something different, and so I told Gary that essentially one way that would keep me in the program is doing a work. I certainly did not feel comfortable reproducing those kinds of theories. I didn't want to be in a position of perpetuating that cycle, of recreating, not recreating, but just making the wheels go round with the same kind of knowledge. What's important for me to say is that also, I felt that there lacked an Aboriginal First Nations presence, although it's emerging now, there's no question about it. But that was one way of assuaging my concerns in my master's work. So then I became very preoccupied about finding a Canadian woman in education. And I came across Wendy. And I saw all the work that she had done. And I saw that for the past 35 years, this is what she was doing, had been doing. Her publications, her books of poetry, her involvement in politics. And I was astounded that despite her presence, that still she had not been picked out and integrated in the literature. So I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to focus my work on doing the life history of a Canadian woman who's dedicated her life to challenging the status quo of education. And to me, that also means challenging patriarchy, the structures of how education is constructed. And so on a fine February 1st afternoon, I invited Wendy to come to OISE to talk, and I invited her to partake in this project in doing her life history. And she accepted, and the rest is history.
Sounds amazing. Do you want to talk about some of the obstacles you're facing in this work?
The biggest obstacle is that I'm doing it from a so-called feminist perspective, for lack of a better word right now, because feminism is a funny thing. A lot of feminists are dead set against the concept of home education, as Wendy is doing it, or as Wendy promotes it. That's the biggest obstacle, because a lot of feminists think that to advocate for home education, you're putting the woman back into the house.
Yeah.
And that you're relegating her to childcare 24 hours on 7, that you are relegating her to doing the housework again. And they feel that the advancements of feminism, it takes a step back with advocating for home education, that women should be on the workforce. Now, of course, I certainly have nothing against that. I'm aiming for that myself, you know, so that's not the point. But the point is, and this is an obstacle, is trying to find a way of exploring this topic by challenging the type of feminism that relegates women into the workforce, that perpetuates a particular status quo in the structure of the economy as well. That's a huge challenge, and I want to be very careful in when I speak about women only, because my challenge is that, but it's not just women that home educate. I mean, couples do it. And as we said, Gary and I, in part one, it is still predominantly women, but we're seeing a shift, and that shift cannot be denied or it cannot be silenced. It's going to be, I think, my biggest challenge, because I'm talking about what Wendy is doing as challenging patriarchy, as doing it from a place of love, and love challenges patriarchy. And I'm not talking the romantic kind of love that we've come to associate love to. Talking the struggles of love, you know, the work that, well, what Wendy has dedicated her life to, I think, is a fine example of that.
Let's talk a bit about, what are you enjoying about this?
Very briefly, I was raised by my grandparents, and being from Montreal, from Quebec, my grandparents had a large family. They had 10 children, and they came from large families, which means as a child, I was exposed to a very large family, extended family. And my great aunts and great uncles and my aunts and my uncles were often around the house. I was this kid that was continuously surrounded by adults of different generations, sitting at the table filled with stories and telling stories. And they would listen to me and they would validate my little stories. And I would ask them questions and we'd engage in these conversations. And so one of my biggest pleasures, one of the, I'd say, even honor of doing a life history with Wendy is those kinds of conversations. She's let me into her life. We get to sit down at a table, on the sofa, wherever we want to, and just talk, just like it was at home, just like it was with my family. And seeing a relationship evolve, I love that. I feel very privileged being able to do that.
The end!
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.